You are now listening to Bookish, The Canon Continues, the podcast that's dismantling the sacred secular divide two books at a time, with your hosts, Michelle Collins and Danielle Kingstrom.
Hello, and welcome back to Bookish, The Canon Continues. I am one of your co-hosts, Michelle Collins. I'm here with Danielle Kingstrom, and we are ready to wow you with some new books today that we've spent the last few weeks going over and reading. How are you doing, Danielle?
I'm great. How are you?
I think I'm better than you. I'm sitting here in 75 degree weather. So as we were discussing, you're still thawing out.
I'm watching the rain melt the snow right now, combined with the mud. It's lovely.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. I want no part of it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful gray day here in Olivia, Minnesota.
I was kind of laughing yesterday because on Sunday it was 91 degrees here. And then yesterday I was shivering because, you know, it was 70.
Yeah, we had like 65 degrees the other day and we were sitting outside just t-shirts on. It was nice.
Ah, you crazy Midwesterners. I don't know.
Yeah. We put our shorts on as soon as it's 32 degrees. Flip-flops are at 36, okay?
Oh my God. I'm not thawed out till it's like 85. I'm comfortable at like 85 to 90. So yeah, I don't think I can ever live anywhere else again. I think it's here for the rest of my life. So
yeah.
But I commend you for your steadworthiness or steadfastness of living in that kind of terrain.
It's a stoic kind of lifestyle, really.
I can imagine. I grew up there, so not in Minnesota, but I grew up in the Midwest. So I remember all too well. That's why I never want to do it again. But anyway, so we got some good books this week. I'm really looking forward to yours. Of course, I'm very much into the whole physical thing and your body and all of that stuff. So I'm really looking
forward
to it.
You're into my body? Yeah, you are. No.
Well, okay, darling, that's not what I meant. But if you send some pictures, no, I'm kidding.
I'll get you to subscribe to my Patreon account before I send you pictures, sweetie.
Yeah, you gotta monetize that shit. I mean, come on. But I am very interested. As we had discussed, I think privately, you had mentioned this book, and then I said I had another book that was very close to it that I had purchased, not for this, but just because I was so interested in it. So let's get to it. Let's talk about your book.
All right. Well, this week I read When the Body Says No by Dr. Gabor Mehti. And he is a physician, a public speaker, and an award-winning author. And this book specifically speaks to exploring the stress-disease connection. So mind over matter. Mm-hmm. So to start out, he introduces me to a new term, which is going to take a minute and a pause to pronounce here. Psychoneuroimmunology.
Okay.
And then we go to psychoneuroimmune endocrinology. Times fast.
Whew. I dare you.
But basically what it is it's a discipline of a study in recognizing the ways the mind and the content of its emotions profoundly interacts with the body's nervous system and immune system and on a cellular level. So that fascinates me. I was drawn to this book. I was listening to a Russell Brand podcast and he was interviewing Dr. Mehti and just kind of the stuff he was talking about and just relating back from your childhood all the way up to your current life, looking back at all of the things that have stressed you out, all of the traumas you've experienced, everything you've possibly repressed, and how that acts on your system and can essentially, according to his observations and theories, lead to disease. And so one of the first things that I thought was, and I have to tell you, there were so many stories. He shared so many patient stories where I'm like, that's my grandma. That's my grandpa. That's my mother-in-law. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That happened to me. Oh crap. You know? And so you start thinking about that stuff. And one of the things he points out, and I've heard this with anyone who I've ever known that has been diagnosed, and maybe you have too, is when you get diagnosed with something significant, for a lot of people, it makes them take a pause and step back and kind of re-examine their whole life. You know, what have I done wrong? What steps could I have taken that would have maybe prevented this from happening? Does this have something to do with this? What is going on? And so that's basically what the exploration of this book is traveling back psychologically and unlocking these trapped memories that might trigger something that you might have repressed that could essentially have some kind of an interaction with your immune system and make you sick. So,
That's interesting. I was just having a conversation earlier today, as a matter of fact, with somebody, and we were discussing the idea of your cell, the cells of your body remembering trauma.
Yes.
And how impactful that is, not only on your psyche, but your physical body as well. You know, there's that automatic stress trigger that happens. And I know I'm very much subject to that. That's why this is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up too. I was just reading an article from The Atlantic they published in November of last year about how trauma can be inherited. Mm-hmm. And I also remember when I was going back, I was learning about post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Oh.
And basically just that, yeah, traumas can be passed on a cellular level. And especially if when experiencing these same triggers and traumas from a genetic lineage, you're also experiencing handling them in the same way as previous generations, whereas there's no actual resolve. You're just repeating the circle of it, and nobody's ever actually gaining any healing that can be passed on.
Right.
And so, yeah, but not only that, just your childhood triggers that leave that impression in every cell in your body, and that sometimes we don't even realize we repress until something else significant happens in our lives and we have this kind of like collision of trauma, past and present. And what that can do is just kind of incredible. And one of the biggest things that for me growing up, you know, my mom worked very hard to teach me how to use my mind to overcome little pains, like growing pains specifically.
Right.
I had the most horrible growing pains. My knees would just, it was undeniable pain, but it was invisible to everybody else. I wasn't inflamed and I didn't have any visible redness or irritation. And so, you know, my mom would just say, okay, in your mind, you have to go through this process. And she would essentially say, start at the top of your head and just start squishing downward. Pretend you're just squishing downward. And I would squish it all the way down through my legs and out my toes. And honestly, it was night after night, this routine, it worked every time. And so like what we do is we have to, physicians used to traditionally rely on this like placebo effect. And so when I think about how my mom used to tell me that, you know, my mind had all of the control and I could push the pain out. And I was reading about, and he's talking about American psychologist Ross Buck, who pointed out how traditionally in the past we had to rely on the placebo effect more or less because A, we didn't have mass production of pharmaceuticals like we do now. Mm. And B, everything was still in such a developmental new trial phase that you needed to be able to observe who did what and on what, with what and without what, and what they had always tried to relate all diseases back to then was what's going on in your personal life. What kind of stuff are you under? And, you know, one of the biggest complaints that Gabor Mate references in his book is that a lot of people, especially cancer patients, feel like patients. They feel like a number and they don't feel connected to their doctors and physicians and specialists. And so what happens is there's already this disconnect. And so the complaint was they never asked me about my personal life and they never asked me about anything subjective and no one ever asked me about my mentality and what was going on in my head and what kind of daily occurrences that I was routinely participating with and whether or not that added to what was going on. And so, you know, and essentially what Mate wants to do is he wants to bring back that old way of thinking where it was psychological and it did have a lot to do with our childhood experiences.
Right.
And because back then we lived in such an era where we didn't really talk about a lot of stuff. And we especially didn't give, you know, a microphone to children to talk about whatever they were going through. You know, children were seen and not heard.
Exactly.
And so... throughout this book, he just goes through and he details his own personal patients that he developed connections with. And so through their diseases, he traced back their childhood traumas or whatever stressors they had going on in their life to see that if through some kind of one-on-one therapy, they could heal themselves. And in a lot of cases, they did. And it wasn't with the help of with drugs, it was the placebo effect. It was understanding that my mind is the drug and my mind is the pill and my mind is the cure. And now that's not the case in all instances.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, some people are just are so far past a stage of cured that if, and what his recommendation is if they can start a new healing process while they're getting ready to enter into their next life. And so one of the great things that I, one of the quotes out of this book I want to read that I just, it resonated so deeply because it's a topic. There's a couple of terms in here you'll probably pick up on too, that just kind of seem to be really prevalent in my purview right now. So physiologically, emotions are themselves electrical, chemical, and hormonal discharges of the human nervous system. Emotions influence and are influenced by the functioning of our major organs, the integrity of our immune defenses, and the workings of the many circulating biological substances that help govern the body's physical states. When emotions are repressed, then there's an inhibition to disarm the body's defenses against illnesses. So the thing that's that stuck out to me is this electrical idea in this cellular level and this imprint and influence that everything we experience can leave on us. And I was listening to a podcast yesterday too, where they were talking about electrical energy and how that has a lot to do with our mentality and more or less harnessing the power that we already have, like the divine power that we already have. And that's what I kind of think this book speaks to. It doesn't seem like he is by any means a Christian, and more or less observes more of a Sam Harris approach, I would say, with intermingling some kind of Buddhist practice, but not saying I believe in a God, because he probably believes in science, which is fine. But yeah, so that's how I saw the inspiration it nonetheless. I thought that just this kind of mentality spoke of Jesus to me. Physician, heal thyself. And now I know I'm taking that very particular verse out of context, because I think he was using it in jest, but it always stuck with me because I think it was meant to mean more than what it meant. And when the crowd tells Jesus in that verse, or he says, I suppose you expect me to say, physician, heal myself, like cast out your own demons before you start casting out the demons of others, because they believed he was filled with demons and he was practicing not of God. And but anyway, that verse always stuck with me and I always refer to it. I mean, that's my thing with my kids, too. I mean, even in my own household, obviously, if there's an emergency or a serious injury, we utilize a physician. But for so many things, I think sometimes kids have a tendency to over-dramatize their owies.
Yeah.
And so I kind of just am always like, don't give it so much power. It's just going to take over you. Let's think about something else. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that works.
Right.
And so anyway, I just kind of really, I love the beauty of that whole idea of physician, heal thyself.
Yeah. I think there's some natural pushback to that that automatically comes up. Because I think you can go too far that way.
Yes.
Which I think has been evidenced by, especially as we're talking about within the Christian realm, or at least my Christian experience. Of course, everything then became a matter of demonic influence, or, you know, nothing was natural. It all became very Gnostic-like thinking.
Yes.
To the point where I have a son that has epilepsy. And of course, for a short period of time, you know, we were taught and told that, well, it's a generational demonic activity in your family because my grandfather had it. I have migraines, which unfortunately I didn't realize is in the same family. I didn't know that until my son was diagnosed. And then of course my son. So they're like, see, it's a generational thing. And so we have a tendency to then negate the whole physical side of everything and say, well, it's one or the other. Well, I think maybe it's some combination of both.
Yeah.
And depending upon our experiences and our trauma in our life, I mean, we may edge to one side or the other, you know, more, but I do agree with you. I think, and I had a thought when you said that kids give too much credence to their owies. Mm-hmm. I remember when my youngest son was little and he would fall down and he would start crying, like, oh, he hit his knee or he hit his head or something. And because it would happen so often, I would look at him and go, what did you do to my floor? And he would stop crying and he would lean down and look at, like, did I do something to the floor? And I was like, see, I knew you were okay. Such manipulation, but you know.
That's awesome. But yeah, but distraction. Sometimes they just need to be distracted from the pain.
Yeah, you got to just take them out of it for a minute.
Yeah, and I like that you brought that up and how it can be taken to the extreme, like that whole the sins of the father passed down.
Right.
And taken to the... And I remember watching Ellen do her latest special she just did, and she talked about the cultish Christian religion she was brought up in and were basically like, your pain isn't real. And it got so extreme that she had hurt herself. She had seriously injured herself. I think she had like a stick literally inside of her knee, and or her kneecap was busted open. And her father was like, the pain isn't real. And she's like, the pain is real. And then she passed out. And so, I mean, you know, like, yeah, that's the extreme where you don't treat injuries. And so I'm not advocating for that. Go to the doctor if it's serious.
Right.
But I am one of those people who are like, do we have to go to the doctor? Because I'd rather not. Let's, you know, and what is this really? So, but again, that sins of the father thing, it stands out to me when I think about the genetic trauma. And sometimes I can't help but wonder if maybe we got the psychology wrong. It's not necessarily that we're cursed from the sins of our father.
Right.
It's that we're going to continue perpetuating the same sins, the same way we deal with things, the same repression, the same trauma if we don't heal it. So, yeah, I love that you picked
that. Well, I think that that's it's very well, we've talked about it before in some of the other books we've read. I think it was maybe in Jesus and the Disinherited, we talked about the idea of that that generational trauma that's experienced by people because of racism and discrimination. And so that trauma does sit inside of our bodies. I had an experience I thought was really strange. I used to go to it wasn't yoga. I don't have the patience for yoga. I need to be moving and doing more. And I tried yoga and I was like, this is not working. But anyway, it was one of the instructors. And I remember going to one of her classes and she was talking about that oftentimes certain kinds of trauma reside in our hips. And I thought, what a bunch of crap. I was like, so ridiculous. But I had an experience one day where we were stretching very strenuously in the hip area, and out of nowhere, I got emotional. I couldn't stop the tears, and I had no reason. And so she came over. She's like, are you all right? Did you hurt yourself? I said, I don't have an explanation for this. And she just smiled at me. She goes, I do. And she walked away, and I was like, damn it.
I do. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I do believe there is that connection. And I also... You know, my family, we're not big on medical doctors either. I've had bad experiences with medical doctors, but we utilize chiropractic and have found, you know, a much, I don't want to demonize medical doctors. I do believe they have their place, but I really feel like chiropractic has its place as well.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And actually is a very holistic approach and actually reaches, some chiropractors will reach into that realm as well, that the idea of trauma residing in your body and how we... How do we approach that and treat it?
Yeah.
So that the person can actually experience some, you know, progress towards getting healthier.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, I love it. I love that you touched back on Jesus and the Disinherited because there was a point of interest that Métis points out in his book is that when he was looking at his stats combined with other statistics that are available, specifically for prostate cancer, is that Black men have a poorer survival rate than white men for all stages. And I couldn't help but go, wow, a prejudiced prostate cancer. But if you go back, the trauma that can be inherited, and if you think about the systemic oppression that Black men face, and let's be honest, we know the realities of Black women within within doctors and ERs and
medical for sure.
facilities.
Yeah, for sure.
And so to assume that it would be any less disastrous and poorer quality for men, you know, we know the numbers, but just to think about that alone and that you have this generational trauma passed down and the kind of stress and repression on an entire race where we need to step back and go, whoa, this is so much bigger than popping pills, and we need so much further healing than just what we can write on a script. And so, anyway.
Well, but the majority of, I think the majority of our medical care, and of course, this is just my personal opinion. The majority of our medical care acts as nothing more than a Band-Aid, though. I think a lot of times we're treating a symptom instead of going to the root and saying, well, what's causing the symptom?
And I think that's not healthy.
I think that we do the same thing in mental health care as well. Yeah. And we've become a generation that is a pill is an answer for everything. And I just don't want to live that way. I would rather go to the root of the problem.
And I agree. And that connection, that subjective experience between patient and doctor is lost on many people.
Yeah.
And so you go in, you're the number, here's the owie, here's the Band-Aid, call me when you need a refill. And you're going, wait a minute. And you know, one thing that I can recall from my own experience is I had a doctor when I first moved out here. I was a single mom. I had two kids. I just delivered a brand new baby, and I didn't have a connection with any of the male doctors. And that's all there were male doctors in this small rural area. And then there was a nurse practitioner that stepped in, and the first appointment I ever had with her, she was like, so, you're a single mom. How's that for you?
Yeah.
And I just kind of went, wait, what? You know? And then it was like, how do you handle when they're both crabby? And she walked through all these questions. And I thought, I've never in my life had a doctor ask me these questions before.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think that's what we're missing. And if you start right there, just for me alone, I was able to cry to her. I was able to go, it's so stressful. Oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. And for her to offer me steps, not in a pill, just to talk to me. And it's just sometimes with many people, having that ability to just express, I'm stressed and here's why. And I feel like no one understands, to an unbiased person, to someone who's far removed from your circle, to step back and look at it from a different perspective and go, okay, and this could be contributing to blah, blah, blah. So he stresses that heavily in here. I stress that with my own daughter. She just switched doctors, actually. She was not feeling connected with her OBGYN, which I thought was kind of important since she's going to be having a baby. So I was like, you need to find someone you feel comfortable with, because you're going to take that stress into the delivery room and you don't want to do that.
Right.
And so she connected with one. She found a new one. And I said, did she ask you how you were doing mentally? Oh my God, Mom, she cared about me. And I just thought, okay, good. So they're out there. But I think we need to make more demands to want that kind of subjective experience in the doctor's office.
Right.
I know a lot of people are like, science can't be subjective, but we're still people connecting.
Right.
And that's kind of what's important.
Well, and unfortunately, I think medical care has devolved in some ways. Of course, we're making medical advances, and that's amazing and wonderful. But it used to be that medical care was about the whole person. And now it's become very, you know, specialized. And we've lost some of the humanity in that. We've lost that, like you said, that ability to connect. It used to be, you know, there's always been that stereotype that surgeons do not have a good bedside manner.
Yes.
And they don't honestly have to most of the time, because most of the people they deal with are under anesthesia. But they still should work on that to some degree, because they do have to have interaction. But just your everyday general practitioner, you know, that should be a mainstay, that you have that connection. Unfortunately, I understand they have time constraints and things like that, and the system's a little overwhelmed, which is obviously something that needs to be discussed. But you're right. I think we as people, as the consumer, have to step in and say, well, this is what I need. Yes. And I'm going to find the person that will provide that.
And I think what I've noticed too is I think there's kind of already been a call to action to kind of help fill those gaps that the doctors aren't meeting. When you think about life coaches and you think about unlicensed therapists and just coaches and people who do group buddy systems and pair up with other people. And I like seeing that kind of a new circle step up to fill those gaps. And I think there's still so many people who are uncomfortable with the idea of therapy in itself. You know, we separate, so many people separate science of medicine from science of psychology. And I mean, what for so long, psychology was considered a pseudoscience,
right?
And still to this day, and I think, you know, the same way we drag a lot of the baggage of our religion with us. We drag the baggage of that understanding of the separation of science and psychology. Yeah. And so then people don't even want to go, you know, get any therapy because they think that with it comes a stigma and that must mean I have a mental disorder and I don't want to be labeled as something because I'm not, because people are so stoic and stubborn, which is funny because that kind of contributes to what he calls is this kind of disease personality. And that's what I mean when I was like, that's my grandma, that's my grandpa. Specifically, we'll just hop over to multiple sclerosis is what really stuck out for me. Mm-hmm. Because my grandmother has multiple sclerosis. She was diagnosed at 26.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's over 80 now. And I mean, she just got into a wheelchair within the last 5 years. They told her she'd be in a wheelchair within like 8 years, that she would just completely degenerate. And she is a stubborn mofo. And she was like, no, I am not ever going to be in a wheelchair. And, you know, over the years, she should have been. She could have prevented a lot of accidents, but she's such a stoic that she wouldn't. And what was interesting is he tells the story about Natalie being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, but he was like, okay, what's been going on in your life? Well, you go back to her life and she had a very hard childhood. She suffered abuse and abandonment and neglect. And then she just basically married the first man that looked at her. And then they never really connected. And he was a snap your finger. When I say jump, you say how high. You better have my beer right next to me. Don't talk to me. I'm leaving for 5 days. I'm going golfing, boating, whatever. Her children suffered from drug disorders. And so even by 16, she was taking a kid in and out of rehab. And that was around the time she was diagnosed. And then her husband got cancer, so she had to take care of him. And she kind of got like no gratitude, no reciprocity. And then she started becoming more ill from her MS and he started having an affair. And I'm not kidding. That's my grandmother's story.
Wow.
My grandmother was a child of what, 13. On her 18th birthday, she was given one suitcase and one blanket, kicked out of the house. Good luck. And so she had to, and I mean, she watched her brother drown right in front of her and did nothing. Wow. She worked. They were all farmhands. She worked a very hard life. She, you know, not only did they go to school, but then they had to sell everything they grew every day throughout summer and winter. And I mean, they were slave children.
Right.
And then kicked out of the house at 18. There was no love and connection. She married one of the first men that looked at her, my grandfather. My grandfather came from a shattered home. And my grandmother suffered miscarriages. My grandfather was alcoholic. He was abusive. He was a philanderer. He was an adulterer. He was always gone. And so she suffered all this stuff, but you never knew it was making her feel anyway. And so what's funny is multiple sclerosis from Greek means to harden. And so he talks about this stoic characteristic, this hardened stubbornness. And I'm like, that is my grandmother. Stubborn old bag, won't show you emotion. That's just the way it is. And it wasn't, and it was only throughout our whole life where she would ever express anything was if she had had like 4 glasses of wine. And then it was
gotta
all
lower
about
those
my
inhibitions.
Grandfather. And I just said, you know, and everyone was like, oh, she's just drunk, you know. And I kind of always thought, well, how come we never hear about this when she's not drunk? Like, I didn't know she felt this way about him, you know, and I didn't know she harbored all these feelings. And then, so it just kind of like reading this story was like, that's my grandmother's story. And what's amazing about multiple sclerosis too is that it's one of those unknown diseases and it's not even something that they've seen demonstrated as passed on genetically. And it's just this inflammatory disease that just presents itself. And in typically most people when diagnosed with multiple sclerosis are like debilitated within 8 to 10 years.
Right.
But for whatever reason, this lady, my grandmother, pushed so hard against the idea of having to swallow her pride and be pushed around in a wheelchair. It was bad enough. She was left and she was abandoned and she had already gone through all this other stuff, but she was so tough and we thought she was resilient, but it turns out she was just repressing it. And yeah, just kind of scary when you think about everything you've gone through in your life. If you're not careful about how you deal with it, what kind of hardening it can literally do to your physical body.
Oh, and absolutely.
I mean, you know, And she always had flare-ups, and the flare-ups always happened whenever something significantly negative happened in her life, and things would take a turn for the worse. And it was like, right. Oh, but just, oh man, just for me. And that's kind of what I do too. Sometimes when I read a lot of stuff, especially things that are diagnosing people, I'm like, is that me? You know,
welcome to the club, my friend.
Right? You self-diagnose. Like when you probably noticed it too. When I started taking psychology courses a couple of years ago, I was like, well, am I a psycho? Nah, I'm not a psychopath. Wait, you know, you're like, wait, do I have this disorder? And so it just kind of made me self-examine. But then I just kind of thought, I wonder if there's stuff that I am repressing that I'm not aware of. And how often do we sit there when we get sick and go, is there something seriously going on in my life right now? Why I'm sick?
Right.
You know,
we just assume a virus. We don't go introspective.
Yeah. Or I'll say, oh, I went out in public this week, so I got exposed to germs, you know?
Right.
Like, ooh, that's what it was. But other times, like, I've had this thing going on for like the past month, just like bronchial thing. And I'm like, I've also had a really stressful month. And so I started noticing it just a couple days ago. And I'm like, we have to snap out of this. We're making our body sick. What are you reading? But it's true. If you start paying attention to just those little stress triggers and you're like, ooh, you know, my husband too, he never gets sick. But when he does, and I'm like, are you fighting with your dad? Are you mad at me? Did I do something? You know, is there something going on? Are you stressed about this? And so we kind of pay attention to things like that. I know sometimes people are like, this guy is some hippie shit. What are you talking about? But
hey, hippie shit's okay every now and then.
I know, right? I love hippie shit. One more thing I just wanted to talk about, which I thought was really kind of crazy, and I've noticed in myself, and maybe you have too, but an absence of stress for a lot of people can actually cause stress.
Oh, for sure.
And because we're so habituated around this, I got to put out all these fires. This is what I do. I just put out all the fires. And then when you come to a phase in your life where you're not putting out the fires, that can actually create this anxiety and a sense of loss and lack within you, where it stresses you out to the point where you might be inadvertently manifesting new stressors to trigger something repressed, because subconsciously you might want to deal with it.
I think that's valid. Yeah. And I think that's incredibly valid. I think you and I have discussed before the idea of being addicted to our own body chemicals. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was you. I discussed that with her. I know I discussed it with my daughter.
Your cortisol and your adrenaline.
My cortisol. Totally addicted to my own cortisol. I also have a psychological theory that for myself anyway, that I'm a deep procrastinator. And I've justified it by saying, well, I do my best work under pressure. The problem with that, though, is that it does inhibit you from getting some stuff done that you'd like to get done. And one of my theories on that is that I procrastinate consciously and subconsciously in an effort to create that atmosphere of stress so that I can function, because that's what my body is used to. It's used to that cortisol release. It's used to the chemicals that are released in my brain when I'm stressed out and I have to perform.
You're down to the wire and you're like, it's go time. We're going to do this. I do that too sometimes.
And so I 100% cop to it. I 100% cop to it. And I'm trying to work on that. I'm trying to be much more mindful of that and to work through that process. Very valid.
Is that like your own little motivation to finally push yourself? Like, I'm down to the wire.
Yes.
Choice now, but that... Yeah. Maybe kind of look forward to that spark of motivation to urge you to.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm working on a doctorate right now. Every degree I've worked on, every bit of school I've ever done, every assignment has been done under some form of stress.
Yeah.
And what reinforces that for me is that I get a good result. I get the good grade. I get the good comments. And so it just reinforces that idea that, oh, see, I work better under stress. And so you tend to perpetuate that cycle, which of course is horribly unhealthy. That level of cortisol in your body is not a good thing. And in all honesty, is coming back to bite me in the ass right now, because here I'm working on this whole competing thing and I can't get rid of the fat around the middle. Well, that's a direct result of cortisol. So now I've got a conundrum, because I'm going to be down to the wire on competing, and I've got to have the result. So how do I manage the cortisol issue there. So, you know, it's something definitely that we have to be aware of. And I think I lend credence 100% to that idea that subconsciously we create our own stress. Because it's a pattern. It's a mental pattern for us that we're comfortable with. Even if it's bad for us, we're comfortable with it.
Yeah. Yes, so. Definitely. Awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, there's just so much in this book that I would say this book is for people who kind of believe in that inner mentality, who are looking for maybe even just a little bit more motivation to kind of solidify what you're already feeling inside. And I know there's a lot of people who are like, no, the doctors. They're the pros. They're the experts. Right. This guy sounds like and I know he's been called a quack. And I know there are similar writers who are like, that's quack. But I don't know. I think it's for those who are more kind of the people who lean towards more of the natural healing would really love this book, would really gain a lot of perspective out of this book. And it's not just all quackery. He's got his statistics referenced.
Right.
He's a practicing doctor. So he's relating to what he's experienced over his 40 years of practice through his own patients and connecting with his own patients. And so I think that the people in that genre who are interested in that kind of healing would benefit from this book. Mm. I don't really think I'd add anything to it. I don't feel like this book is lacking anything. Because he's written on so many different areas. He writes about ADD and he writes about addiction. And he's a recovering addict himself too, mind you. So that's what I have to say. I mean, I thought it was a great book. And
yeah, I said, huge topic for me. I'm very interested in that. I've got another book that I want to read on in the subject. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how that contrasts and compares in light with that one too. So we'll have to.
Yeah, I think it's a big subject. I think a lot of people are interested in it. And as far as people calling him a quack, I feel like people do that because they're afraid to ask those questions. They're afraid to research. Maybe he is a quack. Who knows? But I mean, until you read it and research it and understand it, how do you know? And so,
Einstein was a quack. Okay, you know.
To some people, I think he probably came off as very strange and different. Yeah. Yes. They didn't want anything to do with that. But that comes, you know, that's part of why we read like we do. It's part of why we question the things that we question is because if we shut ourselves off to only that which we believe, we are locked into this pattern of confirmation bias that totally affects everything in our life. And I don't think that's healthy either. So I think we have to, in the interest of health, start evaluating things like he's talking about. Because the mind and the body do work together and we have to respect that.
Yeah. So. And Jesus taught us that too. I mean, that's straight out of the Bible. You know, pastors are preaching about that all the time, your mind and your body. So.
Right. Exactly.
We get with that. Pastor, speaking of pastors, what's your book about?
Well, good segue. The book that I read for this podcast is called Let Us Pray, and that's P-R-E-Y. There's a picture of a nice wolf on the front, so that should tell you something. Nice. The subtitle is The Plague of Narcissist Pastors and What We Can Do About It. I think it would be a mistake to automatically assume that this book was written by an angry individual, although I could see why you would make that assumption. But in that interest, I kind of wanted to very quickly, give you kind of the background of the two authors. There's two authors, R. Glenn Ball and Daryl Poles. Just a little bit about their background. Daryl has actually been working in congregational conflict since the mid-90s. I didn't know there was such a thing as somebody that could work in congregational conflict. Yeah. Although I can see why. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of conflicts in congregations. Oh, yeah. But anyway, I didn't know that was an official thing. And then Glenn is an ordained pastor for more than 30 years in Canada. He's also served as a denominational staffer specializing in problematic congregations. So apparently he got a big problem running around congregations.
Conflict and problematic.
Damn. I mean, that's some serious, you know. Anyway, so they're coming at it from this background. I want to read a little intro statement here that they wrote in their introduction. It says, much of Christian tradition would blame satanic forces for these fights, but I have also seen that used as an excuse to lay the blame on insidious outside forces beyond our control. I say excuse because ascribing it all to Satan lessens the responsibility and guilt of those involved. which in turn is often used as a justification to avoid the hard work of truthfully confronting ourselves, repenting, and both seeking and granting authentic forgiveness, and then building healthy reconciliation. Wow. And we talked about that a little bit ago, the idea that often in the church, a lot of stuff gets blamed on Satan. He is the ultimate scapegoat.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you that are well-versed in mimetic theory, he actually is the authentic scapegoat. I remember growing up and hearing things like, well, the devil made me do it. I had a shirt that said that, I think.
Yeah.
I remember that phrase. But, you know, that tends to be the mindset. So here's my own disclaimer in reviewing this book. This book is about pastors that are narcissistic. Mm-hmm. If that isn't you and you're a pastor, please don't self-identify or say that I'm identifying you as a narcissist. I believe people are capable of being a pastor without being a narcissist. I'm a pastor. I'm ordained. I don't think I'm a narcissist. And going back to what you were saying about your book, where you're sitting there like, wait, is that me? I seriously did that like 15 times reading this book. Yeah. I was like, holy shit, I got to review myself here. Where am I at on this?
But I think I'm, dear Michelle, you yourself told me, if you're asking yourself if you're a narcissist, you're probably
I know. But then again, it could be, I could be sneaky. I could be the sneakiest narcissist you've ever met.
Yeah,
so.
You don't know.
Exactly. So they actually provide a disclaimer here because there was an actual study done. This book is actually the result of a study that they did, and it was done in Canada, but it was an actual sociological study. So here's their disclaimer. We are reporting the overall pattern of how pastors scored on several levels of narcissistic beliefs and behaviors. Patterns that revealed an unexpectedly high percentage of participants who had high scores in destructive narcissism well within the diagnostic range of narcissistic personality disorder. We must also remember that no measure of any mental disease is completely accurate when it comes to individuals, and that specific diagnoses on an individual level can only be done by highly qualified therapists and clinicians. People that know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, I like that better.
Putting it in layman's terms. So what they're saying is, look, we did a study. We are not mental health professionals. We conducted a study based on a questionnaire that actually was constructed through the use of the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual for the APA. And as such, they were able to identify overall patterns. What they're saying there is, look, we can identify overall that we feel this percentage of pastors fit into this range. However, each one of those pastors, we are not individually diagnosing as having narcissistic personality disorder.
So I heard that's similar disclaimers like that when psychologists would get up and talk about whether or not Trump was narcissistic.
Of course, you know, everybody's got an opinion.
I love those disclaimers.
Well, the reality is
a truth behind just mere observation. Too,
absolutely. So. Absolutely. And I think we talked about this early on in the podcast is my word is spectrum. I believe everything exists on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And the authors here actually do make the point that, look, all of us have narcissistic tendencies. That doesn't mean we're diagnosable. It means we fall somewhere on a spectrum of identifiers for narcissistic behavior. Some people are pushing those limits, I'm going to say, but it doesn't mean they're diagnosable. So,
yes.
So we want to be careful with that.
Right. And if we are mimetic creatures, then we're probably influenced by other people who are expressing their narcissistic qualities. And that doesn't, I think we all have phases like that anyway. So say that I'm not a narcissist, but have you been? And will you
have you
be?
Displayed Probably. That kind of behavior?
Right,
yes, more than likely. Yes. We all have.
Yeah.
But so before we get kind of into what they're talking about, I thought it would be a really good idea to kind of define narcissistic personality disorder. I mean, I think we all have an idea, but there is a diagnosable level that is established according to the American Psychological Association and in the DSM. So I'm going to read this is out of the DSM. I'm going to read the definition. Narcissistic personality disorder is a pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior, a need for admiration, a lack of empathy, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts as indicated by five or more of the following. And so it gives a list of the different attributes that somebody suffering from narcissistic personality disorder might display. And to be diagnosable, you have to have at least 5 of these. And I'll just read them real quick. The person has a grandiose sense of self-importance. They're preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. They believe they're special and unique and can only be understood by or should associate with other high status people or special people. They require excessive amounts of admiration. They have a sense of entitlement. They are interpersonally exploitive. That's a big one. They lack empathy, or they're unwilling to recognize or identify with the feelings and needs of others. They are often envious of others or believe that others are envious of them, and they show arrogant, haughty behavior or attitudes. So to be officially diagnosable, you have to have 5 or more of those qualities.
What happens if you have all of those qualities?
Oh,
well, are you like extreme narcissist? Otherwise known as
the best narcissist ever known to man.
Like
that's
my ex. That's my ex. You just listed my ex.
I think every person in America has somebody they can go, oh, I know somebody like that.
I think I could say I like know like 7 of these people and I'm related to most of them. Oh, no.
Well, it's funny. You know, we laugh about it. I mean, it is a serious disorder. And they make the point, you know, that it's actually one of the one of the disorders with the lowest treatment success rates. And it's probably one of the most destructive. And of course, obviously, it's the most the lowest treatment success rate, because most people that are narcissistic would never deem to think they're narcissistic. So they wouldn't look for help.
Yeah, they wouldn't go to therapy. And
right.
I wonder what that stems from. I'm curious.
Well, their contention here is, and it does make a lot of sense, because we tend to think of people with, you know, that we consider narcissistic as, you know, that arrogant, loves themselves, constantly needs affirmation and attention. Well, you know, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, the idea of going back to the foundation, because those are symptoms. So what's the foundation?
What are they lacking?
Right. Well, often what they're lacking is a healthy sense of self-esteem.
Yeah.
They're actually functioning from a place of low self-esteem, feelings of disconnection again. As a matter of fact, what they have found is that one of the foundations of narcissistic personality disorder is that people that suffer from it were denied love and acceptance at some crucial junction in their life. And so they don't know how to connect. So the only outlet they have is themselves. And so there is that deep sense of disappointment in self that begins to manifest in trying to prove that you're better than or greater than or more talented than. And so you become your own focus. And you need everybody to know that. And so it's really very insidious in how it shows up. Oftentimes anybody that's dealt with somebody that is, you know, on the more serious side of that spectrum of narcissism can probably testify to the fact that narcissists are deeply manipulative.
And then that they end up as pastors.
Yeah, which is incredibly frightening. Because again, and I have a different view of pastors.
Do they think Piper's a narcissist?
I don't know. I honestly, I mean, again, that would be individual diagnosis. We have a tendency to identify those negative traits, you know, in people and make those, you know, suppositions. Unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, we're dealing with people that are just very hurt.
It didn't get a lot of love from as a child. Yeah. That's hard for a lot of us to step back and even consider when we're confronted with someone like that. We don't want to be, you know, my daughter came home and complained about someone. She was complaining about her father, the narcissist. But you know, I made a point. I had to step back and I'm like, his mom didn't love him very well.
Right.
You know, and I witnessed that. I mean, I was in that home with them. She just didn't. And she came from a place where she wasn't loved very well. So it's that trauma that you pass down that can actually create a lacking and a disconnect that you keep rebirthing. So,
I've joked about this before. I think I have some meme on my Facebook wall somewhere that says, you know, the bad thing about being empathetic is you feel bad for assholes too. Yeah. And so a lot of people would identify somebody in their life as narcissistic as an asshole. But yet when you start looking at the reasons why they behave the way they do, you kind of go, God, you know, I can feel for them because I understand how they got to that place. Yeah. That doesn't justify or explain away their behavior. and the destructive tendencies, but it does allow you as a person to enjoy some empathy, which, by the way, would show you you're not a narcissist because they don't typically have empathy.
Yes, yes.
They have an underdeveloped sense of empathy. Yes. So they have a quote here relating to the foundations of narcissism. It says, thus they create their own enigmas. They attract followers as part of their deep need for admiration and often charismatic image, but then attack those same followers and drive them away, creating the need for more followers. It should not be a surprise then that the narcissist trusts no one, as all of his closest confidants are in a continual state of flux, with the exception of those who attach and subjugate themselves to the narcissist to meet their own wounded emotional needs. It's a seriously messed up process because they're continually hurting people, pushing them through almost, you know, a mill of pain, and then moving on to the next person, all in an attempt to surround themselves with people that admire them. Which is again, it's sad. It makes me mad because I know people that have functioned this way, whether they were actually diagnosable or not. I won't make that determination, but obviously, you know, you can pick up on some of the tendencies. But they go on to say that people have a difficult time understanding the paradoxical qualities of the narcissist, particularly that narcissism is more about shame and self-hatred than it is about loving oneself too much. Self-aggrandizement and self-promotion are in reality a glittering mask covering deep wounds filled with toxic shame and self-hatred. If we could see the inside of some of the people that are struggling with this, I think we'd find sorrow for them.
Yeah,
you know. But of course, when you're in the middle of a relationship with a narcissist, that's the last thing you feel. It's funny. They actually provide quite a few stories in this book about narcissistic people that they've come in contact with in what they do in working with problematic congregations and things like that. And some of the stories are amazing. But what's ironic to me is how much I was able to pick out some things and went, oh yeah, been there, done that.
Yeah.
You know, as far as having dealt with somebody like that. So that to me is a little distressing. Especially as you said, when we're talking about the role of a pastor, and I have a different view on being a pastor. I struggle with the term. Because I really feel like that term has become an all-encompassing term for anybody that works in ministry of any kind. You know, we automatically assign a title of pastor. The problem with that, though, is in my estimation, being a pastor is a heart issue. It's not a vocation, although it can be a vocation. It can turn into a vocation. I really believe it's a heart issue. So when you're talking about pastors, in my mind, I'm talking about somebody that is a shepherd, that cares for the sheep, that is, you know, concerned for people. So if you have somebody that's operating in a role that's called pastor, but they don't have that personality to do that job, we've put a lot of unrealistic expectation on them, which creates pressure and stress. But we've also put ourselves in a place of having expectations on somebody that are never going to be realized because they're incapable.
Yeah. And so the emphasis then becomes more on the noun of the pastor versus the verb of the pastor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so it's that, you know, that reality of expectation on both sides that creates situations in which we find these kind of personalities stepping into the role of a pastor. And when you think about it, they also talk a lot about that traditionally a lot of roles where you'll find narcissistic people tend to be people that are CEOs and people that step into the limelight in control of a lot of people. So when
you end up being a president or something.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. but so as it pertains to pastors, when you think about it, I mean, most of us think about, I don't know, because I tend to come from smaller churches. I've been to one, you know, I've attended one mega church in my life, but most of the churches I've attended are smaller churches. So you don't tend to think of those kind of personalities being in charge of smaller purses, but churches, but that's not true. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
Because actually a smaller church makes sense. That's less people that you have to control and manipulate.
Yeah.
And so
it's easy to become a celebrity too.
Absolutely.
Like,
and everybody looks up to you.
Yeah. You're a celebrity in a small town, especially when you're a pastor and there's a church on every corner.
Right.
Communities idolize pastors.
Absolutely.
And so what ends up happening is they're reinforcing to this position
they're reinforcing this grandiosity for them, which is only giving them more credence to say, yeah, well, your God.
It does do that. And then there's a reciprocal event happening inside as well. They are reveling in the attention, mm-hmm. but deep inside them, there's that mechanism that knows they're not that.
Yeah.
And it just creates more shame and insecurity, which then fuels and feeds that need
to play
for
that
more affirmation.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Our mind is an amazing, fascinating thing, you know, and when something's mm-hmm. out of line in there, it's actually fascinating when you think about the process. And that's where I get to, you know, I step outside of the personal manipulation and whatnot and go, wow, that's actually fascinating how that functions. Yeah. But those feelings of security, they talk about that. One of the points they made was to counter the feelings of insecurity. They actually project those feelings onto other people.
Yeah.
And they do the best to make those unwanted feelings a part of the other person. So projection is very much a reality within narcissistic personality disorder. Mm-hmm. All the negative that a narcissist feels about themselves, they then project outwards to somebody else so that they then can feel justified that they're okay and that they're just a victim of instead of the perpetrator.
Yeah.
And so that becomes very interesting again to me anyway. I get all, you know, worked up into the psychology. But so there, the more that you as their victim feel insecure and inadequate in their presence, the more comfortable and powerful they are. I mean,
yes, wow.
on an emotional level, that's sick, obviously. Yeah. I mean, to revel in somebody else feeling badly, you know, yeah. I mean, we're all guilty of comparison. Don't get me wrong. Like, I have a horrible problem with comparison. And unfortunately, I always end up on the negative side of it. So,
yeah.
I hear that. Damn, I got to get better. But, but the narcissist is deeply manipulative about these things. And there's actually, they talk about manipulation. Let me see if I can find my list here. There's actually a progression. Oftentimes you'll find a narcissistic person starting with positive reinforcement, which sounds like a good thing, right? Like they're telling you all the good things about yourself and they make you feel loved. They make you feel accepted. They make you feel special. Like you're a part of their inner circle.
Yeah.
And that's really them just it's meant to pull you in, right? Yeah. So that now
they seduce you.
Yes. So they have influence over you now. Mm-hmm. And then the pattern progresses and that positive reinforcement becomes more intermittent. You don't get it as often. So when you do get it, you're pulled back in closer again. Like you may have started to pull away, but now you're pulled back in because they're offering up something that you had gotten used to. It's like a drug, you know, because we all want to hear good things about ourselves. We all want to be liked. So they know how to manipulate that behavior. It then progresses into indirect aggressive abuse, you know, little anger temper tantrums and whatnot. They begin to blame other people. Mm-hmm. They start using language that can be considered ambiguous, you know, like, well, you've gotten better at that, you know, but you're not as good as me. So it's kind of that push-pull of, let me give you a little bit, but I'm going to still slap you back down into your place.
Yeah.
And those words actually become empty after a while. They actually then devolve into denying or invalidating reality. I've had somebody recently that I dealt with and said, this happened. And they said, that never happened. Like, and I literally walked around for 2 days going, oh my God, wait a minute. Did I remember it incorrectly? Mm-hmm. Wait, maybe I'm wrong. And then I'm like, oh my God, I'm being gaslighted. I know what happened, but they're just absolutely ignoring it. Like it didn't happen. Or they'll minimize, you know, they'll say, well, I realize it looks like a lie, but I was really just, you know, exaggerating. Yeah. So they're justifying their own behavior. They begin to withhold their presence from you. I mean, they've gotten you used to being a part of their inner circle and suddenly they're kind of withholding that. They actually go into actual lying or lies of omission, denial, like I said, just saying, no, that never happened, even when there's proof of it.
Yeah.
Which is mind-boggling. And then they'll get to where they're turning the tables. Suddenly you're the enemy. And all the discussions that they're having with other people are now about how they can't believe you've turned on them. They can't believe that you're this. And you're left standing like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
Like, and it's funny.
You're like describing so many people in my life. My gosh, I have flashbacks.
Well, they actually talk about, and so we have to kind of give ourselves a break because they actually mention in here quite a few times the idea that people that are actually professional therapists, that are licensed therapists, have been taken in by narcissists many times.
Yeah.
And not in a counseling session, but within their personal lives, people that they've come into contact with, and they miss the signs. Yeah. And they're trained for this. So it's not an easy thing to deal with because our first thing that we do is automatically assume that we're wrong. I do anyway. Mm-hmm. So that just feeds the narcissistic's story. You know, they go, oh, well, see, it was you or whatever. But then they actually, so I got to hurry here because I know we're running out of time and I want to make sure I hit all the high points here. So they actually go into the study a little bit. And of course, the study was done by questionnaire. It was done in Canada. I'm going to read, they have another disclaimer here on their study. It says, neither of us is trained and licensed mental health professionals. We are not diagnosing anyone for narcissistic personality disorder, nor are we qualified to do so. What we report in the coming pages are the result of a study that utilized a validated instrument that tests for levels of narcissism and toxic NPD. Actual diagnosis for an individual is more complex. What we are reporting is the numbers and percentages of pastors who met the diagnostic criteria, as I outlined earlier, as determined by the test instrument. In other words, we're writing about patterns of thinking and behavior rather than looking at individuals. So what they did is they had over four, I think it was almost 500 pastors that were given this across denominations in Canada. Men, women, old, young, they, you know, made sure that they did well with the demographics of it. Mm-hmm. This questionnaire was given to them. Some of the people ended up not finishing the questionnaire, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like I thought they kind of went, oh shit, maybe I'm narcissistic, which actually kind of is funny because that probably means they aren't. But anyway,
yeah. I don't want to finish it.
Yeah. I'm not sure I want to know the results of this. But out of the people that did do it, they found, let me see if I can find my number here. It was over, let me see. Gotta get to the right page. Sorry. The responses indicated that 31.2% of all active pastors in this particular mainstream denomination met the diagnostic requirements for a finding of narcissistic personality disorder, both overt and covert. 31.2%.
Wow. That's crazy.
A third of the pastors tested diagnosable. We're not even talking about the people that are on the far end of the spectrum. We're talking about people that are actually diagnosable by the standards.
Wow.
That are standing in pulpits and pastoring people. That's frightening. That to me is absolutely frightening. And so they do differentiate. I won't go into it very long. They do differentiate between overt narcissists and covert. And they actually indicate that covert narcissists are actually much harder to determine. Those are the people that actually
covert.
Well, yeah, they're covert. Yeah. The word says it all. But they basically, you know, they have that appearance of humility, self-deprecation, things like that. But it's used as a manipulation. It's used to draw people in to say, no, you're not those things. You know, no, I don't see that. And so it is a manipulation still and much harder to identify. The danger in having a narcissistic pastor, and they go into this in some detail as well, is the idea that you can actually end up with a narcissistic church. And that church then begins to function in ways of denial, like they won't recognize what's happening, or even if they do, they won't admit it. They
like
actually
the Westboro Baptist Church.
But I thought this was interesting. The next one, uniqueness, because I'm going to tell you how often I've heard this crap. I'm going to read you some labels here. You tell me if this makes sense to you. These are church slogans, okay? Church without the boring parts. Real church, real people. Guidance in a misguided world. A place where miracles happen. walking in faith, discovering a community, molding believers, influencing the world, transforming our cities one life at a time. We're boldly going where no faith has gone before. These are all statements that are setting themselves as somehow they're different and better and unique than any other church out there. That is a symptom of that kind of personality. Now, that's not to say if you've come up with some quirky little tagline like that, that you're diagnosable. Please don't misunderstand me.
Yeah.
But as a church culture, and I have attended churches like this where we saw ourselves as better than other churches, where we saw ourselves as more advanced spiritually, that we had the right answers.
Oh man, I mean, you can hear that in sermons.
Oh, absolutely.
Your pastor is saying, "We're better than the Baptists. Yes! We're better than all of the and you're like, "Wait a minute. What does that matter?"
Right?
Yeah, it's crazy, but it's prevalent.
Well, and what ends up happening, I mean, he's got a few others here, grandiosity, entitlement, paranoia, paranoia and isolation. That's a big one because then you start bordering on cult status. When you start isolating yourself from community and feeling as though you alone have the answers, you know, and protecting yourself, not allowing new people in, that becomes very cultish, in my opinion anyway. He also lists a lack of empathy. But here's something, and we've all heard of this, that it leads to a rationalization. The narcissistic church, and he goes into this example. You're familiar with the man named Harold Camping?
I don't know the name. No.
Okay. Harold Camping. He's a piece of work. A lot of people will recognize his name. He is a guy that is one of those big guys on end times predictions. Okay. And he actually set a date, May 21st of 2011, the world was going to end. 2011. Okay. He's obviously wrong.
Yes.
When that didn't happen, I remember billboards. There were billboards. A warning of this. When that didn't happen, he adjusted his prophecy to October 21st of 2011. Apparently, he made some kind of numerology, mess up or something. So what I'm saying is this leads to rationalization. This idea like, well, I can't be wrong. I'm the authority. I know everything. Yeah. You have to adhere to what I'm saying. I just made a mistake. And the idea that people will continue to adhere to that person. I'm going to ask you a question. How many people do you suppose have written or bought the book on the blood moons? Over and freaking over. We have pastors warning against stuff as though they are the authority and they're proved wrong and people still follow them. Now, that's not to say each one of those pastors is a narcissist, but this is a symptom of that mentality. The people that are allowing themselves to be victim of that mentality. So when he was, Harold Camping, when he was approached about this, like, hey, you were wrong. He was questioned about, how does that affect your moral responsibility to the people that, call themselves your followers? His response was that he deftly washed his hands off. He said he's not responsible for anyone in particular. And he attributed favorable motives and outcomes to himself, blamed his followers for following him, and then blamed God for changing the second coming without notifying him.
Oh my gosh.
What the hell, God? You didn't tell me this was happening.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry, but that's a serious problem. But
damn it, God, I didn't get the memo. What are you doing? God.
And I remember when all this was going on, and I remember thinking, Jesus, how do the people keep following somebody that is making these predictions and claims, and yet they're not coming true? Well, because people are easily manipulated, to be quite honest. We all are on some level.
Yeah.
But we want to believe the best of those, that, especially if they're called a pastor. We want to believe the best. Yeah. And so, it becomes a situation in which a lot of people get hurt. The narcissist themselves ends up hurt. They're a damaged person.
Yeah.
And of course, the healing that is necessary in that is something that's very difficult and it's very time consuming. You don't just heal overnight from this process, being the victim of a narcissist or from, recognizing that your church atmosphere may be a narcissistic atmosphere. You don't just say, okay, we're all better now, or hey, let's just talk about it. It's all over now. That's not how it works. There's deep psychological damage that's been done and it's going to take some work to work through it. They do actually provide some area of prevention ideas. Honestly, there needs to be a better interview process when you're hiring pastors for a church. There needs to be, personality testing, and they give quite a long list of things that you can do for prevention. It's a great book. Obviously, it's a deep subject. It's a dense book. I loved it because that's what I'm studying. Well, not necessarily this subject, but psychology in general. So I loved it. But honestly, there's so much more in there that probably could or should be said. But I know we're close to time, so I don't want to take up more time.
Well, people are just going to have to go buy the book.
Yeah, you should have to read that book. Well, so I think we're going to leave it there today. And obviously, if we're still interested in it, we can still keep studying it and reading and writing and talking about it. So,
yes.
All right. You want to take us out of here?
Oh, yeah. Well, why don't you tell everyone what you're going to be reading for next time?
Oh, I know everybody's so tired of his name on our podcast, but I'm going to say it one more time. The great Jamal Givenchy. I know. We're going to start charging. But the great Jamal Givenchy just released a book through Choir Publishing called Living for a Living. I've read it. I've loved it. I know Jamal personally. He's my life coach. So I tracked with him on everything that he talked about. And so I may be somewhat biased, but I love the book. So I'm going to be discussing that next time. What about you?
I read Jamal's book too. I read it last week. And then this week I started my next choice, The Sophia Code by Kaya Ra. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, there are so many similarities and concepts between both books. And I know, I'm going to just give a little teaser. There is a particular part in Jamal's book where he speaks to the masculine energy, mm-hmm. and the Sophia Code is about the feminine energy. Oh. So I thought right there, we'll give you a little bit of dose of both there.
A little contrast. Yeah. Alrighty.
Yeah. So that'll be exciting. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if there's a book that has inspired you and you'd like us to consider discussing it on our next show, email your recommendation to us at bookish@choir.com, or you can go check us out on our Facebook page by just searching for the Bookish group. And we will not ask for blood or DNA for you to enter into the group.
Yet.
And remember, if we choose your book, we'll make sure to give you a shout out on our next episode. Hooray. And so here's your shout out, Jamal.
Huh, there's your
shout
out.
Thank you for the recommendation, Jamal.
Yeah, like he hasn't had 50 shout outs already. All right. Well, it's been fun.
Until next time, then. It has been. We'll see you next time, guys.
All right. Take care.